The Oracle Network.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Jules, and this is Riddle Me That True Crime. So today's guest that I have on is a returning guest. It's Maggie Freeling from Murder and Alliance and Unjust and Unsolved. Today, Maggie and I are going to be talking about the cases of Andre Brown, J.J. Velasquez, Temujin Kensu, and we're also going to talk all things Murder and Alliance and David Thorne, the murder of Yvonne Lane. We're also going to touch on the recent suicide of one of Maggie's friends. So I'm going to give a suicide trigger warning. If this is a sensitive subject for you, please fast forward to about the 3 minute or 3 minute and 30 mark if you want to skip over that conversation. It's kind of an informal start to the episode, but we're going to jump right in. And I'm also going to give a trigger warning for language because both Maggie and I may swear a little bit in this episode. So I do apologize if this is something that you don't enjoy, but it was difficult to bleep out every single swear word in this episode. So I hope that it's okay. Hey, Maggie, welcome back. How are you doing?
You know, it's been a crazy time. That's why I'm so late. I'm so sorry.
No, don't be sorry.
My best friend died like a couple weeks ago. So I was like at a bar meeting another friend, just like kind of just talking about it.
Are you okay?
No, but like it's, you know, it's been like a month. So I'm like functioning, but I'm just like, just kind of a mess, more of a mess than I ever usually am. So.
Oh my God, I'm so sorry. That's awful.
Thanks. Yeah, no, I know. I like that's a lot to like throw on you, but like that's why I was late. Like I just like couldn't leave this friend. I felt so bad. Like I was literally just sitting at a bar, but like I just couldn't get away.
Oh, that's so terrible. Like, do you mind me asking how it happened?
It was suicide. She left my house and then an hour later. Was
that's so sad. I'm so sorry, especially because it's somebody you're so close to, and it was so close in time to when you saw that person. Like that's
a lot. She was at my house, like not doing anything weird. Like I had no idea that she was sitting there with a note in her pocket. Like I just had no, and it just makes me like wonder, like myself, and like the intuition that I had. You know what I mean? Like. I feel like these things are so weird when we talk about like crime and death and stuff all the time. And then like in my own, I was just like, how did I not see this? How did I not notice? You know what I mean? So it's just like, it's been weird to try and process it, but you know.
And I think in those situations, people try really hard to. I've gone through periods in my life where I've had like suicidal ideation and I would go out of my way to not show that.
Yeah.
And there could have been the potential that I could have acted on that and people around would have been reacting the same way as you. So she probably went out of her way to not share that because
she did. Like she apparently had a note and knew and just like did not want me to know that. And that like makes me feel crazy. It makes me feel crazy. I'm like, how did I not know? How did I not? You sat with me for 2 fucking hours before you did this. Like, how did I not see that? And like, there were weird moments, but I'm like, what could I have done? You know, and like, I'm not blaming myself. You know, there was a lot of other people involved, but it was just like, it's tough just thinking about like, you know, our career and everything. I'm just like, how did I miss that? And going to the David Thorne case. How did I miss that? I was just like, really, like, how am I missing these things?
But honestly, though, like you went in wanting to find out what the truth was with David Thorne, and every sign that he was innocent was there, or potentially there was a wrongful conviction. So I can understand why when you looked over that case, you were like, whoa, this deserves to have a closer look.
Yeah. No, for sure. And you can use any of this if you need to. I don't mind. I've like talked about it a little on my social media, but it's a good segue to David. So I'm so happy to see you. It's been a while.
I am happy to see you. And for those of you who haven't heard our previous interviews, I spoke to Maggie about Maura Murray and about Darlie Routier. So I'm really excited to have you back. Unfortunately, I'm so sorry for your awful night and for your awful, you know, week that you've been having, but I'm really happy that you're here.
I'm happy to be here. It's so great to see you. You are like a ray of sunshine.
Oh, thank you. So are you. Even though you're going through some serious shit right now, you're still, you know, just light. You always exude such, you know, a light.
I try, but you know, it's been actually like really crazy and dark since the David stuff, since I started having those realizations. Like, things definitely have been weird since then with me.
What has it done for you personally? Like, since you, like, what point did you actually get to covering the case that you were like, whoa, things aren't as they seem, and now this is challenging all my preconceived ideas?
I think there was a particular moment when we were, and by we, the private investigators and myself, John Harden, Danny Waxler, and myself were in alliance, and we were sitting with Sue at a restaurant. And Sue, you know, we were just talking about everything, and she was still like, are you guys going to take the case? And they were like, we don't know. We hadn't talked to Joe yet. We hadn't talked to David yet. We were still pretty preliminary on a lot of things. I mean, it had been a few, it had been months, but we were still just like digging in. And something came up in conversation about how David knew about Yvonne's sex work, which, of course, I had been told he didn't. And so that's when we said, back up, Sue, what are you talking about? She's like, oh, well, that's when he would take her to the conventions. That I never knew anything about conventions. I had never heard about conventions. And so we were all just like, skirt, what? And that's when I realized this person had left a lot out with me. And not necessarily at that point been untruthful, because, you know, I guess maybe I didn't specifically ask about conventions. So it was just more of like omitting information. But that moment where we were all sitting there and she was like, I thought you guys knew this. Why wouldn't he tell you that? And I was like, well, he obviously didn't tell us that. And that's when I went back to him, not the conversation that people heard at the end of the series, but another conversation. I went back to him and was like, I need you to tell me X, Y, and Z about whatever you knew, because I've asked you before and you've omitted. And now I found this out. And that's really when I started getting suspicious.
Yeah.
Like, conventions, like, how? And I didn't mean to interrupt you, but just like, what? Like, how do you leave that out?
It's a major detail. It's sort of like he told you he didn't know about it, but then told other people something different. And it's like, if you're driving her to conventions, his role in her sex work is then in question as well. Like, were you pimping her? Were you getting a cut of this?
So then it was just like, when I asked him about it, which is a conversation that was played in a part of the series, but not like the final conversation, he said, oh, well, yeah, I was driving her to train stations, but I didn't know where she was going. I didn't know what she was doing. I didn't ask. Okay, that was one conversation. And then, you know, when the guys talked to you, it was a totally different story. So like, that moment with Sue was when I started realizing, and I think she started realizing too, like, you guys don't know about this. You've talked to him for over a year. He didn't tell you this. You've at like, it was weird.
And how does it feel like when you've invested so much time? And like, you could have picked any case, right? You chose his case because you believed that. And I did too. Like, when I looked at everything, and I think everybody who heard the early episodes agrees, there's so many question marks there. Got a corrupt police force, so many people who have a potential motive to have wanted to hurt Yvonne Lane. So I totally get why you chose the case. But how does it feel when you realize, like, all of this work that you put in believing that David Thorne is innocent, and now you're being led down a different path? Like, how did that feel emotionally?
I think everybody heard how I felt in the series. I mean, I was wrecked. It was devastating. And I don't know if personally I have felt that kind of devastation, because it's different. It's like, you know, a lot of times when you find out somebody's not who they said they were, it's like an intimate partner, or maybe like a best friend, like someone that you've been really intimate with. David and I were not intimate. It was like a, it was a relationship based on what I assumed was honesty, because I'm trying to get you out of prison. You need to tell me everything to be honest. The guys told him he had to tell them everything to be honest. So my base assumption was like, this is somebody who I do believe is innocent. So thus they're telling me everything honestly. And when that wasn't happening, I just was, I don't even know how to explain it, because you're right. All I could think about was, wow, what about Ralph Stokes, who deserves this platform? You know, what about Brandon Spencer, who deserves this platform? What about Tracy Zorns, who deserves this platform? Those are all cases I've covered before where I know the person is innocent, where we know who the other person is who did it. And I took a chance on a case with somebody who, you know, just like them, didn't have the help, but I thought the case was interesting in the sense, like, you know, some cases, like if you listen to the podcast, you know, this case has it all. It has everything. And so I thought this one would be a really good one to get people who didn't care about wrongful convictions to care about wrongful convictions, because it's a murder mystery. It's a sex mystery. It's a baby mystery. There's so many mysteries in it. And that's why I picked it. And I really regret that.
I can see why you picked it. Like, there's, you know, at the heart of it, I always go back to like little Vinny, you know what I mean? And those kids that were left behind at this crime scene. And it looked like they were treated with care. We know that obviously David was their father. Joe knew these kids and had spent time at the house out at least a couple of occasions. Do you think when you look at the crime scene, like it was brought up, I think, in the podcast, that if Joe had done this, would he have thrown that TV on Yvonne, or is it possible that David later went back and did that?
You know, the idea of David going back was new, and that came from good friends, Brett and Alice, I think. They brought that up, the prosecutors. I don't think that's impossible. I also think that perhaps it is possible that Joe did trip on it, like he said. You know, it's when I talk to John and Danny about this, you know, the evidence and the facts point to where they do. And that is, there is nothing concrete pointing away from David and Joe, in that we don't have any other suspects that could have been there. I mean, it just came down to, where did Joe get this money from after he saw David? I mean, it's just to think that there was so many coincidences happening. And look, it does happen. It does happen. But this is so tight. It is tight. And I think so much of it, when we went into it, was based on, we had been told that everybody was lying and everybody was coerced by the police. And that's just not true. So when you take that away, the evidence really does leave David and Joe. So back to your question, you know, did Joe do this, or did David go back? I don't know. I don't think we're going to know, because neither of them are going to tell us the truth. And in Joe's defense, I don't think Joe knows the truth. Like, I've talked to Joe now, you know, since the podcast. I wasn't able to talk to him during, because the guys were doing their investigation. But Joe and I talk now. We video chat. And I don't believe he knows. I think it's really similar to my good friend Charles Erickson, another wrongful conviction. In the opposite, Charles is innocent and was convinced he did it. I think Joe did it and is actually convinced he didn't. And I think his memories of what happened really aren't there. You know, so I don't think we'll ever know some of the odd things that seem weird, like the TV and the photograph between her legs. And I think all of it is interesting, but when it comes down to it, I don't think it matters.
Yeah, I think you're right. It pretty much all points towards Joe and David at this point. Like, you exhausted every single option. And early on, the one thing that was a question mark was that confession, like that audio confession where Joe speaks to the police. And I know when you gave all the info to Brett and Alice to cover it, they went over that. And, you know, in listening to that, that was the one thing that stuck out. Like, he's either been very convinced or coerced by police, or he's just a really good actor, but it was just so emotionally raw. And then when you later talk about how the Enochs took him in, and when they took him in, he had like 50 cents or something. Yeah. And then dudes out there like buying rollerblades and like work boots and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, well, if he didn't get the money from David, where did he get the money?
He didn't have money until he saw David that day in the driveway. He was telling the Enochs that entire weekend, I need to, like, where's David? If you see David, I need my money. Three people all confirmed that. I don't believe that they're all lying and coerced by the police. There's no way. They all remember Joe saying, David's coming with my money. And then David shows up. There's not even a denial that he was there. So we know he was there. And Joe suddenly is ready to go shopping. You're either the unluckiest people or this happened.
Doesn't Joe say something like, oh, it was for cleaning out the garage or something?
Originally
like
said
that
it was for cleaning out the garage, and there was no garage clean out. There's no garage clean out. So Joe knows he got money from David. You know, that's the frustrating part. We have David, who's a liar. You know, not even about like this particular instance, just the other lies that we caught him in. So we know we're dealing with a liar, a manipulator, somebody that I believe has narcissistic tendencies, and then somebody else who has severe trauma. We'll never know, because one person's not going to tell the truth. The other one doesn't know the truth.
It's so unbelievable, too, that it just so happened that the Alliance police force happened to be so corrupt. And what are the chances that this murder victim would have been, you know, involved sexually with up to like 10 or 11 of the Alliance police officers? Like, that looks like a good outside motive. And then when they go to the psychic, like, that episode blew my mind.
Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing that's just so crazy is like, The fact that the police force was involved with her, and we have documented instances of officers stalking her, harassing her. You know, it's just, man, if there was ever a case that had a good wrongful conviction claim, it's this one. But after working it as hard as we did, more than anybody else did, and to be clear, anyone else who has worked this also never found any evidence of innocence. I just don't believe it. I don't believe it's there. I don't think it's there. And like, you know, now we're 3 months out from when I originally started processing all of this, and I feel pretty. I have not thought about David Thorne. I will say that. I think he's where he belongs, and I have not sweat over him since we finished the series.
That's good. At least you've come to a place of acceptance. And I think nobody who listened to your podcast ever judged your choice to choose David Thorne's case. I think everybody only respected you more for following the truth. And I mean, you went on an emotional journey. I think it was, you could tell it was psychologically difficult and you were just so drained by the end of it, but it was honest and it was raw and you put yourself out there. And I think that was incredibly brave of you.
Thank you. I do appreciate that, because I did not feel that at the time. At the time, I felt really stupid, you know, like really like this is my career. I'm a 30 something year old woman. And like, this is my job. And I just felt so wrong and like I wasn't doing my job right. So I'm glad that I chose to be transparent about it so we could all process it together. And I think that that helped that because a lot of people are not transparent with their work.
No, I think you're right. Like people will have a narrative at the beginning. And if something doesn't fit their narrative, like you see it in pretty much every case you covered on Unjust and Unsolved with the prosecutors where they leave out exculpatory evidence because it doesn't fit their narrative. And so it's like, yeah, there always seems to be a Brady violation in like every single one of the cases. I wanted to talk about a couple of the cases that you'd covered on Unjust and Unsolved because I'd like to talk about them all, but obviously we don't have like, you know, 30 hours. So let's talk about Andre Brown first, because this case really blows my mind. Do you want to give the listeners just like a brief synopsis of the case?
Yeah. And then I also just want to ask you like why it blows your mind, because, you know, it's funny, Andre, I've heard that from other people. Like when people join the Unjust and Unsolved Facebook group, it's like, what was the last episode? And usually people join after a compelling episode. And Andre's episode is usually when people join after. And I've had people message me saying it was the most compelling one. And I'm just curious why. But so this case happened in 1999 in the Bronx. Andre Brown was a young man in his maybe 20s, I think. And he was out one night and two other young men in the Bronx were shot. Nobody died. One of them was paralyzed. It was an attempted murder. And a few days later, Andre found out he was the prime suspect. And he turned himself in. And we all know what happens after that. In 1999, when you're a black man, that's a prime suspect in an attempted murder case. He was eventually arrested and convicted based on bad eyewitness testimony. Andre has now spent 22 years in prison. There's a lot of updates in his case that I can share with you once we get into it. But his is ultimately bad eyewitness identification and really horrible defense.
Just right from the beginning. I mean, he was obviously came from a good family. It's just unfortunate that his mom ended up going to prison and, you know, he was hustling, making money. He got shot and it was a pretty devastating injury, right? Like it tore apart his leg to the point where he needed physical therapy. And this is what the first part that blew my mind, because this shooter was identified as running. And due to the injuries that Andre Brown had sustained, it was impossible for him to have been the shooter and to have been running like the eyewitnesses said. So that's like one of the things for sure.
So that was never even brought up in his original trial because his attorney, I just want to make sure I have his name here.
Lee, I think.
Thomas J. Lee didn't present to the jury that Andre was severely injured. Not only could he not run, but it was very difficult for him to walk. Today, he still walks with a limp based on his injuries. So the fact that this eyewitness allegedly saw somebody chasing the two survivors, it wasn't Andre. He physically could not run. I mean, he was disabled. And that was not presented at his trial. As it turns out, Thomas J. Lee is, I want to say, the first attorney ever placed in the FBI's Federal Witness Protection Program for testifying against the Bonanno crime family. His defense attorney was in with the mob. So Andre, you know, he wound up getting disbarred and racketeering, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, this guy was not a good attorney. And Andre really got screwed by him.
And he used, rather than using like an alibi witness, you know, which he could have used. He could have used that. He could have used, you know, the doctors or physical therapists to say he couldn't have done this based on the injuries he sustained. He chose instead to send a bullet to the eyewitness to basically intimidate her out of testifying, which also blew my mind. Like,
I forgot about that. Yeah, he was such a mob. He was a mob attorney. I mean, that was, yes, yes. That's so crazy. I forgot about that. Bonkers.
So, amazing that you say bonkers too, because that's the name right of the other guy.
I must have like just subconsciously been thinking.
Yeah, totally. So then he does that with the bullet, and then the judge agrees, which is totally, I've never heard of this in any other case, to have the eyewitness, I can't remember what her last name is, Stephanie something, but to give her grand jury testimony, to have it read. She doesn't actually have to show up. Yeah. So he doesn't get the chance to confront his accuser, which it seems to be an odd move.
Right. And she's the one, she was in a traffic stop when she allegedly saw this. So again, the question ultimately, or should have been from the beginning, how credible is this eyewitness when you saw two people fleeing while you were sitting in your car and we're not even part of this, you know? Like, it's interesting because I just went through this in the real world. I had a friend get punched in the face outside of a bar by a man, young girl, my size. I mean, in her 30s, but a small woman. And a random dude left the bar and punched her in the face. And so when we went to the precinct to report this, they would not let her do the ID because she had been hit. And I was like, you know what? As somebody who works in wrongful convictions, like, I appreciate this. I appreciate that you are making sure it's a good ID. They wouldn't even let the bartenders who were inside that knew the guy left do the ID because they didn't see it happen. So to have somebody who's in their car a significant amount away, not involved in this incident, do the ID, that's a bad idea. I think that's a bad ID.
I think it's a bad ID too. And eyewitnesses who are under very stressful circumstances or situations, they don't have more accurate memories. They have less accurate memories. And she ended up in the hospital, I think, that night with an attack of angina. So this is obviously an incredibly stressful thing. And it was dark outside. I just don't believe that in the dark, a couple blocks away, she would have got that good of a look at his face.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's the thing. Like, I had friends doing this lineup, and they weren't even sure. They saw the guy in the bar. They saw the guy outside of the bar. They were trying to ID him. And they were even like, I think that's him. I'm not sure. It's very hard. It's hard. And it's really devastating that his entire case was based on a witness ID.
And there was posters that were put up of his face. And I think her eyewitness identification was made after the posters were up. So the seeds already planted in her mind that here's the guy.
Yeah. And we see that a lot. We see that a lot.
Yeah, it's super unfortunate. And then we find out later that there was another shooting like a few days prior or whatever. And the guy, Virgo is his last name, that was the one who survived. He ID'd Andre Brown, but he said in the earlier shooting that it was this guy named Bonkers, right? So I guess they'd had some like turf beef and it was over weed, but it never made any sense because Andre Brown was selling crack, not weed.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Andre, here's the difference between Andre Brown and David Thorne. Andre Brown admits to things that he was doing that weren't, you know, what we would consider okay. You know, Andre was trying to make ends meet in the 90s in the Bronx selling crack. And this whole altercation started over turf wars with marijuana. So yeah, it wasn't the same drug. It wasn't the same turf. It wasn't, you know, you're not going to buy weed and then, you know, stealing business from somebody selling crack. It wasn't like that. So what turned out to happen was Bonkers and one of the survivors were in a shootout a few days before. And it seems like this was the now I'm going to get you moment because Bonkers knew that they were going to be at this corner. It is so wild to me that Andre has spent 22 years in prison, especially, you know, all of his appeals were denied, which, you know, we tend to see. But we do know that the Bronx district attorney has been fighting to uphold his conviction. And so in March 2020, I think it was before pre-pandemic. Let me just make sure. Okay. So March 2020, a judge agreed to have an evidentiary hearing for Andre, which is great. That means he can finally show the evidence that I couldn't fucking run. Couldn't run. It wasn't me. I wasn't chasing down guys shooting them. I couldn't fucking run. So he's finally going to get an evidentiary hearing that should hopefully exonerate him. However, the district attorney was fighting that hearing and said that, you know, it's not proper to do it virtual. So the entire pandemic, even though a judge ruled, Andre was granted a hearing for a year and a half. He did not get a hearing, which should not happen. That should not happen at all. He is granted a hearing to present his evidence. And the district attorney denied it. I went to protests for this up in the Bronx. Finally, now that we're out of the pandemic, he's gotten a hearing. Andre has a hearing on, let me just make sure the date is there. Andre's hearing is December 15th. And it's an evidentiary hearing. So after 22 years, he's finally going to have the actual evidence heard in his case.
Well, I think it was like ineffective counsel for sure. The sense that Mr. Lee just basically took the approach to like, hey, we're going to intimidate them. I'm not going to have any contingency plan here. I'm just going to go with that. Let's forget about the alibi witnesses and let's forget about the evidence that he could not have physically done this. Instead, I'm just going to rest on sending a bullet to the witness, which ended up biting them in the ass later because that witness wasn't challenged on the stand.
It's crazy. And Andre's case is certainly one that is made for TV. And I know that he has some really good prospects of his case being, you know, out there. And I know he's going to get out and I know he's going to be with his wife and his son who... Gosh, when we did the interview, he was 7. So AJ Jr. must be about 8 now. He's got a full life to live. Luckily, he's one of the, you know, I would say happier stories. You know, it was 22 years. That is a long time, but he's still young. He's got a young kid. He's got a wife. Like Andre's going to get out. And it's just despicable what has happened to him. And I really hope and know that he will hold people accountable.
I really thought it was a good story. At least at the heart of this, he's got Tamika. And then when he talks about like manifesting little like AJ into existence, I thought that was so, so cute. Like he's got a full life, even though he's behind bars. So at least he has that, but he should be a free man.
I meet and talk to a lot of people in prison and they're often pretty positive. You know, it's like, they have to be, but Andre is really one of the most positive that I've met. Like Tamika is so wonderful and Andre is so wonderful. And it's just like, you know, his kids aren't grown and they didn't grow up without him. Like he really does have a life to live when he gets out and not saying nobody else does, but I feel like so much of their lives had been stolen from them. Their kids are already grown. They missed all that. You know, in the case of my friend Ralph Stokes, he's in his 60s now. He spent 44 years in prison. You know, that is a life stolen. And fortunately for Andre, to even say it was only 22 years, you know, for him, it's incredible. But he will have a kid to raise and a wife to be with.
What was the name of his lawyer that he eventually had that had been wrongfully convicted? That was such a cool story that was tied to it as well. Like another wrongful conviction. And then he gets out, gets these settlements and then starts up this foundation. Deskovic. That was it.
Deskovic.
Right?
Jeff Deskovic is also a friend of mine. Jeff is wonderful. Jeff started his own foundation to help people like Andre. And Andre is one of the cases that he has. And, you know, it was really wonderful to be at, you know, these rallies for Andre because Jeff brings a lot of exonerees and there were a lot of exonerees there like supporting. And it was really beautiful. And people like Jeff, people like Marty Tankleff who get out and help and, you know, get law degrees. And that is their goal to help the Andre Browns. And not saying a law degree is the only way to do that. I mean, there's many, many, many people who do this, but just specifically in this case, you know, Jeff got out, he had money, he got a law degree, and like, this is what he's going to do.
So speaking of people who've been wrongfully incarcerated and who help other people, JJ Velasquez. So you told me there's a happy ending at the end of this one. And I don't know the end of the story because I just re-listened to your episode and I didn't Google it because I wanted to hear the good news. So can you give a synopsis on JJ Velasquez's case?
Yes. So JJ was released from prison after 24 years in August. He was commuted by Governor Cuomo. And I was at the release. I mean, JJ and Andre, I cannot wait for them to meet. And I told Andre that JJ will be at this hearing. I'm going to be at this hearing. JJ is going to come with me to Andre's evidentiary hearing. You know, the circumstances are so similar, just bad eyewitness IDs. They're both in New York, you know, Harlem and the Bronx. And so JJ, his sentence was commuted. He got clemency. He got out and he is freaking living his life. JJ is somebody that I had actually gotten to visit in prison before COVID. And so I really developed like a deep connection with JJ. And he is such a good person. I mean, what he did on the inside, I mean, he created educational programs while on the inside at Sing Sing, you know, one of the most notorious prisons in the country. JJ was creating educational programs for guys in there. He would talk to me about helping start journalism programs. So JJ is now out. He's with both of his boys, his two sons. You know, speaking of missing your kids grow up, they are pretty grown. One is 23-ish, one's 26. They're their mid-20s. So he's got grown kids, but he is free. He's with them. He's with his mom. You know, they're all still alive. And sometimes that's all you can ask for when you've spent decades in prison.
And he got his degree in behavioral sciences. And while he was behind bars, before he even got out, the fact that he helped three other prisoners get their convictions overturned, I thought that was such an inspiring story. Like, he's not even out yet and he's helping these guys and they're now free.
So that happened. So much of JJ's story is credited to Dan Slepian from NBC Dateline. He covered JJ's story in 2012 and put it on Dateline. It's really crazy that, you know, it's 2021, a decade later, and he finally gets out after that Dateline episode. But when Dan started meeting with JJ, JJ would tell him, like, hey, look, I know these other guys in here that are also innocent. I know they're innocent. And Dan covered their stories and with JJ helped get them out. JJ was really advocating for these guys that he knew was also innocent in prison to get them out. And at the time I met JJ, it was so sad that, you know, these other guys got out and JJ helped. And here he is, you know, 20 something years later, still in here. But they were at his release date. I mean, there were so many people there. It was beautiful. Dateline was there. The New York Times was there. You know, we were there, his kids, his mom, other guys he had just done time with that aren't necessarily innocent, but like who JJ had touched their lives. He is a beautiful person and he's going to do amazing things. He already did from inside. So what he's going to do from the outside is going to be really amazing.
It was so awful, though. Like right from the beginning, it was so clear that this was a misidentification and that eyewitnesses were coerced. Like he goes into this gambling den owned by Albert Ward, right? He was a former police officer. And the eyewitnesses said that it was what, like a light-skinned black man with braids. Mm-hmm. And that didn't describe JJ Velasquez. But yet the police seemed to put him in all of these photo lineups and the people that he was pressuring were people that were like holding heroin or had other charges and saying, we're going to pin this on you if you don't identify someone.
So he was completely railroaded. They had him in the sights because his picture was there from something really dumb. JJ didn't even live in Manhattan, in Harlem. He lives in the Bronx. So the fact that, you know, they had his picture, at this point, I don't even remember what it was for, but they had a photo of JJ from some time he was brought in for something stupid that he's obviously not in there for. And so anytime you get brought into a precinct, your photo can be put into a lineup. They have your photo. You have a mugshot. So JJ's photo gets put in and somebody IDs him. And that's really where it spiraled. From there, it was like, okay, we're gonna nail this guy. He doesn't have a quote solid alibi. He was at home. So we can nail him. We can get him. And that's really what happened. And in JJ's case, we know who did it. We know who did it. We know who the light-skinned black man with dreads is, or braids or dreads. Very obviously not JJ. He never even had long hair. JJ is not a black man. I mean, it's his case is really incredible. And I think that's also why he's out. However, you know, it's really unfortunate his appeals were denied. He should have been out sooner. He got out really because Cuomo fucked up being a sleazebag and had to do something good on his way out of office. Because JJ's petition was denied. We applied for clemency. And by we, I just mean like his entire team. You know, I wrote letters, like JJ's team applied for clemency for him last year. So the holidays are when clemency petitions are due, and then they announce clemency during the holidays. JJ was denied last December. And then this whole scandal happens. We don't think anything of it. We're just trying to figure out how to get him out. You know, he's been denied clemency for his second or third time. Cuomo fucks up. Got to do something good. Let me free some people. It's so arbitrary. You know, the fact that these appeals were denied and then the governor just gets to be like, you're out. And the fact that he was denied and then gets out. It's just, it's so frustrating. He could have been out a year earlier, but just because he didn't want to grant it, you know, it's like you denied it and then you granted it a year later.
Something in that episode where somebody says, and I can't remember, it might have been Dan Slepian, who says, the system like doesn't care about justice or whatever. They don't care about truth, right? It seems to just railroad people. Like the balls on it. Was it the district attorney who, when they asked for the missing 34 police reports or whatever it was, yeah, and they said, this isn't discoverable. There's nothing in here that, you know, needs to be read. So sorry, you're not getting them. It's just like, you're even going to address it and say there's nothing in there. And in one of those reports was the bombshell evidence, right?
Being who the actual perpetrator likely was. You know, I talk about this all the time with Brett and Alice, who I know have been on your show, just about, you know, in the work that I do, it always comes down to corrupt prosecutors. corrupt prosecutors and corrupt cops, which not every prosecutor is corrupt, not every cop is corrupt. But in the work I do, you're not getting wrongfully convicted unless those people are corrupt. So in this case, it certainly was Brady violations, you know, the prosecution purposefully withholding these reports that said who the killer probably was based on the evidence. And it's just disgusting. And the fact that you can't hold these people even accountable, you could sue the state. Great. Does the person who prosecuted JJ's case feel any ramifications of that? No. Does the cop that had it out for him feel any ramification of that? No.
That's the unfortunate part, right? Is we see so often in these cases of wrongful convictions, when there are Brady violations, not really a big deterrent for prosecutors, right? To not do that. Because no. If they don't turn something over, they basically get a slap on the wrist. Nothing major happens to them.
They're nothing. I don't even know if they get a slap on the wrist, because they're going to say like, oh, I didn't know. You know, like, it's so weird because I'm watching Dexter right now and I'm watching all these cops who are like presented as like really good cops who want to do the right thing. And when they find out that, like, you know, one of the murderers might not actually be this person, they're getting all the evidence to like be like, we can't bring this case to court. And I'm like, you know, all the cases I work, that's not how it happened. They just double down and make up evidence, or, you know, coerce witnesses, threaten witnesses. And that's the world that I live in. And it's real. I have covered 21 cases where that is a reality. And that's just the cases I've covered. Right now, I have a list of 15 cases, new cases I'm going to cover on a new season that, you know, that is the case.
Well, it's exciting you're doing a new season of Unjust and Unsolved, because that just brings a new platform to all of these other cases. So one other one I really wanted an update on, I don't know if there is any, is one that you covered, and then you also gave the information to Brett and Alice, and they covered it on the prosecutors, is Temujin Kensu. Is there any updates on his case?
No. Poor Temujin. also, I was going to bring him up when we were talking about JJ helping free people. Temujin's also a jailhouse attorney. Temujin, you know, the passion for righting wrongs burns really deep in Temujin. I mean, he is just a passionate, fiery, forceful person when it comes to justice. And he's won, I think it was like 6-ish cases in prison for just, you know, horrible living conditions. This person was treated this way. I mean, so in terms of his case, he's been in, I'm going to say 35 years now. I know the mask that I have says 34, and I'm just going to go since that was last year. We're approaching 35 years in prison for something he did not do, something that the state acknowledges he didn't do. And yet he's basically being held hostage by the district attorney. It's a really complicated situation. I don't exactly know who is falling on who at this point, but I do know that the state conviction review unit reviewed his case and concluded he's also innocent. I know that the governor has definitely backed writing wrongful convictions. So why his case is held up right now when the governor's own team said he's innocent, it is very unclear what's happening. Temujin has a really great, wonderful, large team of folks that are working on it. I know his case, really, he just wants media attention now to put the pressure on the state. So I've been reaching out to, you know, the Datelines, the 2020s, to see what we can do about it, because his case is also just devastating.
So many alibi witnesses. There was just so many that it was like he could not have done this. And the motive just wasn't there. It seemed to be so perplexing because it was like he wasn't with this girlfriend anymore or whatever. And it sort of seemed like, why would he go out of his way to do this when he didn't seem to care? None of it really seemed to line up at all. But it was just, he was easy pickings, I guess.
For him, it just comes down to that he was poor, I think.
Yeah.
And they knew he wouldn't have a defense. He was tangentially linked to the people in this case. And that's what's so interesting. It's like, okay, so he was poor and of course couldn't, you know, hire a great defense team like we've seen the Kyle Rittenhouses do. And at the same time, their argument is that somehow he chartered a private plane to get 450 miles to commit this murder. So, you know, it's just ridiculous. His case is very obviously xenophobia.
Because of the whole ninja angle, right? Yeah. They didn't understand that part of it.
Temujin is a white man, born a white man, Frederick Freeman. And while in prison, well, before prison, he got really into martial arts. It was the 80s. You know, I often think of the 80s and I think of the Bruce Lees. Like, martial arts was this like exotic thing in the 80s. You know, so Temujin was really into it. And so the whole case was that he was this like time traveling ninja. He was able to get from one place 450 miles away to the next place. And he's a ninja and like, who knows what he does? And they put all of his like martial arts stuff on display in court and was like, look at this man that's doing all these crazy criminal, like wild, exotic things. And his whole case was, you know, how some cases are based on racism. His was very obviously people that were afraid of, had no idea about Eastern religions, Eastern culture, which were things that Temujin was really into and cared a lot about.
I think he was just born at a different time. Like now that's very accepted and it's more commonplace. Like lots of people do martial arts and are very into,
yes,
you know, Buddhism and stuff like that. So
every white girl I know does yoga, you know, it's like, you know, it was the 80s. He wore a leather jacket, rode a motorcycle. It was like, this guy is a ninja killer. And yeah. He's very much not.
So you spend so much time doing things for other people, working on trying to overturn wrongful convictions. When you have off time, like how do you take care of yourself? Because I know you're a big mental health advocate. Like what do you do to, you know, take care of yourself? What is self-care for you?
So I luckily have a really amazing partner and self-care is often just like going to a dinner where like I can just like scream about whatever I need to scream about. I also ride a motorcycle. You know, Temujin and I bonded over that. You know, when he gets out, I'm like, I'm going to come there. And he's like, we're going to buy all these bikes and we're going to ride around. So like, I love riding my motorcycle. Honestly, sometimes just putting on a podcast and doing dishes because, you know, the crazy frantic lives we live, doing dishes is often a novelty because I'm just like, wow, I can actually just like have a peaceful moment where no one is freaking talking to me is like my moments of zen. I love just putting on documentaries and just smoking some weed. It's legal in New York. I can do that. And watch movies, you know, that's my self-care. But really just helping people is what makes me happy.
Yeah, I can tell it just shines through with like everything that you do. And like, I think everyone that listened to Murder and Alliance, they saw how emotionally invested you were in wanting to do the right thing, right? And wanting the truth to come out, but wanting to help people. And I think that's such an admirable quality. And I think you're such a beautiful person.
Jules, I think you're a beautiful person. And I'm so happy we've connected. I was thinking about that today. I'm like, man, I can't wait to meet her in person. Like, for real. When's that going to happen?
I know. I'm really hoping to come to this, hopefully this crime con. And okay. Because Robin gets a couple extra seats at his Trail Went Cold booth. So okay. Ashley and I might come and do that. So that would be really fun to meet in person and have a couple drinks.
Come to New York. Just come to the city.
I love New York. I haven't been in a long, long time. It's a great city.
It's here. It's waiting for you. If you come, we will have great times. But yeah, no. COVID was weird, so of course we haven't met. But I look forward to that. And yeah, I think it's hard. I mean, to have so many people to care about all the time. You know, I was looking at my phone today, and I had like, I'll tell you. Charles Erickson called me today. Nikki Zinger called me today. Ralph Stokes called me today. And Brandon Spencer called me today. All while I'm just trying to like work on my life and process my life and the grief and the trauma that I just dealt with my friend. But at the same time, I'm like, I also want to be there for these people. So it's hard. It's a lot, but it makes me happy to answer a call from Charles Erickson and have him write me a letter afterwards, just being like, thank you for listening to me for the 15 minutes. You know, that's what makes me happy. And that's what I tell people when they say, how can I help? It's like, just be there, just be an ear. Think of all the times you need an ear and think if the ear that you had was your cellmate, you know, just write them and offer to be there.
So when you went into journalism, like you got your master's in, was it like health and sciences?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what was your objective when you got that? Did you know you were going to be in true crime journalism?
No. And it wasn't even something that I wanted to do. Not that I didn't want to do it. Like I was always obsessed with true crime. Like, you know, I think I've said in another interview with you, like it was always my dirty secret. You know, when I was a kid in the 90s, like that was not something people watched. Like the OJ case had just happened. Like the true crime wasn't a thing. And so for me, watching, you know, Forensic Files or like, you know, when ID became a channel in, you know, the early 2000s, like that was like really secretive. Like I would like sneak in my room and watch this stuff. And my mom came in, I would like change it because there's like dead bodies, you know? So like I always loved true crime. I was interested, passionate. Never in my life thought this would be like a career. So when I started in health and sciences, I was really interested in conservation reporting, animals, wildlife. You know, the concept of transgender rights was new then. I thought that I was writing when I was in Philadelphia reporting. I was reporting about how Philadelphia had or Pennsylvania had just started discussing health care for trans people. So that's where I thought I was going to go with my health and science reporting. Didn't go there. I still very much care about those things, but I never thought I would be here taking prison calls six times a day.
Well, I think you can definitely say that your work is impacting so many people in a positive way. And the fact that you're getting the stories out there to like millions of listeners, you know what I mean? And this has to mean so much to these individuals.
That's all I can hope for. I mean, Andre, going back to Andre, you know, when he wrote me today and said that there's a big production company interested in him, I was the first podcast that ever did something on him. His story had never been told. That was the first time. And he was so grateful to have his story told. And now I am so happy there's another platform interested in his story. You know, same with Brandon Spencer. His story had not been told appropriately. And now it is. And now he has these attorneys. And it's like, just getting the word out there is so, so important.
And some people, when they cover cases, they like gatekeep a case. But like, that's never your approach. I was talking to Brad about how, like, how did it go when they'd covered David Thorne's case? And what was your feeling on it? And he's like, you know, Maggie was so good about it, right? She didn't care which way we fell. She just wanted us to go over the case, to get to the truth. And wherever that led us was okay. Like, she wasn't invested in any outcome. Like, well, I'm not surprised because that's just how Maggie is. But you just like push them out there because you want more eyeballs and ear holes on these cases, not just your coverage.
It's such an interesting line because I encountered this recently with Ralph Stokes' case. Ralph is, he's been in for 40 years. I think I accidentally said 44 before. It was not 44. That was Ronnie Long. So I'm going to correct it now. It's been 40 years. Ralph is now in his 60s and he hasn't had anyone tell his story. I was also the first person that told his story. And now there's a Philadelphia Inquirer journalist interested. And I'm also a journalist. However, I put the fact that I am a human before that, where you were just saying, I think many people who put that they're journalists before human will gatekeep, will do these things that some of us perceive as like sketchy or shady. For example, she refused to tell Ralph, to tell me, to tell any people close with him some information she found out. There was a point where something she was doing was not going to help Ralph's case. And I tried to reach out to her as a journalist and as a human saying like, look, like journalist to journalist, but also human level, this is not good for him. If you do this, you know, if you have any care for him, like, please don't do this. And I think that's where the line between journalist, I kind of cross it because I think of people as humans first and people first, and being a journalist comes second to me. So I know there's a lot of gatekeeping. I know there's a lot of things happening that I wouldn't do. And I think it's because those people are thinking of their jobs first and not people.
Yeah, I think that's a great point because I think you value the lives of these individuals that you're reporting on before your right to it. It's their story. You're reporting on it, not it's my story because I reported on it first type of idea. And I think
not my story. And that's what I make very, very clear. These are their stories. And I think that's, you know, oh, Ralph's calling, you know,
not, just talking about him, his ears are burning.
I know. And it's in no way like I am not in any way like giving myself the praise, but I have been praised for people I've talked to saying like, thank you for telling my story truthfully to the way that I've told it to you, you know, and not twisting their words or taking it out of context, making it very much like, this is not my story. This is not about me. And whether or not I wind up a character, David's story, it's still your story. And that's where the truth is. And that's where I think I am a good journalist, because while I am thinking about, you know, being human and trying to not cause harm, I do tell the facts, and the facts are in their own words.
Yeah, you were an excellent journalist, I will say it. So I think that everybody who's praised you for that is absolutely accurate, because you do put being a human being first, and you put the lives of these individuals you're trying to help above the idea of somebody else covering it. Like, you're very inclusive and like invite everyone in, like, hey, look at this. This is an injustice. Like, please, everybody cover this.
I, yeah, I have a big mouth and I can't shut it. And if I see something wrong, I'm going to scream about it from the top of the mountain. And that's how it's going to be. And it's gotten me in trouble. And it's also helped people get out of prison. So I don't know. That's just me. And it's just how it is.
So when is season 2 of Unjust Unsolved launching?
So there are things in the works that I have not been told I can't talk about, but I'm just not going to say it yet. But I think this, what is it, spring? I guess this spring after the new year, you can expect something new from me.
That's exciting. Okay, can we please talk again in like a month or something about a few other cases that you've covered on season 1? Just because I'd love to revisit these again. And
yeah,
they're so interesting. Like, let's get them out there again and talk about them. And any excuse I have to talk to you, I'm going to make an excuse.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many updates and so many cases. Like, now that COVID's over, I've been able to actually visit some of these people in person. I went and visited Charles Erickson a couple of weeks ago, which was amazing. So, you know, these people that I've now been talking to for 2 years are now becoming physically real to me as well, which I think is very important. And which is why, you know, full circle going back to JJ, he was the only one I had visited. So I visited Ralph now, I visited Charles, and JJ's out, but I visited JJ. So there's a lot of updates to talk about.
Yeah, I'm excited. Okay, so let's do next month. We'll talk about like a few more cases. You can give some updates. And anybody who's listening, I'm going to link Unjust and Unsolved in the show notes, as well as Murder in Alliance. And Maggie, where can the listeners find you on social media?
I am on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all Maggie Freeling. You can find me there. I am very responsive, particularly on Instagram. If you message me on Instagram, I will likely get back to you. If you're submitting a case, there is a submission form. I do not take case submissions in DMs. There is a submission form on the contact page of Unjust and Unsolved. Please submit it there. It will not get lost. If you DM me, it will get lost.
Thank you so much, Maggie. And I look forward to talking to you next time.
Jules, thank you so much.
I want to thank you all for listening. So during this episode, we talked about some difficult subjects such as suicide. In the show notes, I'm going to link some suicide prevention hotlines, so I highly encourage anybody who's having suicidal thoughts and ideations to click those links. I'm also going to link Unjust and Unsolved, the episodes for JJ Velasquez, Andre Brown, Temujin Kensu, and I'm also going to link Murder and Alliance for anyone who hasn't listened to those episodes. If you want to support Riddle Me That on Patreon, there's no specific Riddle Me That Patreon. But I do have a Patreon with Dr. Ashley Wellman, which I'll link in the show notes. It's patreon.com/JulesandAshley. If you want to reach out, you can do so via email at riddlemethatpod@gmail.com. You can also reach out to me on Twitter, where I'm very active, @podcastriddle. So until next time, stay safe and remember, accept nothing, question everything.